Welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Jam. I think this is maybe our last one. I don't want to reveal any big reveals I'm not supposed to, but I think this may be our last one doing fully remote like this for a while. Does that sound right?
Maybe. A couple more weeks.
Maybe?
Yeah, a couple more weeks. My hope is we'll get at least one in person together. Then I may be out in an undisclosed location as well.
Oh, okay. The Citadel bunker.
A couple things happening. Max is going to be traveling, like you just said. And then still working out a few wrinkles with our future setup. But soon.
Cool.
TM, two weeks.
2 weeks.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, I will be back. So anybody who's around, I will be ready to throw up cameras and hang out. Like we did that first time where we were sort of all hanging around in the group together. That was fun.
Should do that again.
Yes, it was here. Yeah, there was someone visiting Max and myself yesterday, and he was recalling one of our sessions, but he was clearly recalling the first one because he said we were all together in person. So, yeah, I think we're all excited to have that dynamic.
Yeah, that'll be good. All right, well, when we get to that, we will probably continue to rug the audience by telling everybody we're going to talk about the Bitcoin Strategic Reserve. So I figure might as well, you know, start with that. I put that in the title again today. But we're actually not going to fully rug the audience because this strategic Bitcoin reserve, I think, is a topic that keeps coming up. It's always in the news. And, you know, it feels like it sometimes goes a little more toward Bitcoin and sometimes goes a little bit more toward broad basket of crypto assets. I thought I heard a clip online, and maybe you guys can tell me if this is true or not. I thought I heard a clip with the crypto and AI czar, David Sacks, saying something like the person had asked him about, like, oh, is it true that you're doing a Bitcoin reserve? And he said, well, you know, he kind of laughed and he said, well, we're studying Bitcoin. But then also XRP is this, you know, Ripple cryptocurrency, maybe the worst example of decentralization that this crazy space has seen. But it feels like that's one that is getting a lot of attention because I think they're spending millions of dollars to try to promote the idea that XRP should be part of that reserve asset. To me, that feels like a nice starting point to think about, like, why, I mean, we're all Bitcoiners, but why, you know, why would you not be interested in XRP, for example?
Just real quick for additional context, this week, there was news about Czech Republic considering up to like 5% of their reserves being put into Bitcoin. So their own strategic Bitcoin reserve. So I think that's notable.
So hadn't there been like 14 states, I thought, either had made a move or done something? I thought Texas did something, Illinois did something. Obviously, Wyoming's been on this for a while.
Julian Farr, go on Twitter, has been covering that. I don't know all the states, but he's been reading each of the different bills as they're coming out or each of the different proposals. So he's a good account to get all the lowdown on that.
Cool. So Steve, you added the additional context of, like, this reserve thing is becoming a popular idea everywhere, but are people generally, like, when you hear people talking about, you know, reserves for kind of sovereigns, do they feel like they're generally trending toward Bitcoin centric views, or are they sort of more general crypto assets? And how often does XRP seem to play into the narrative there?
I'm not super concerned about XRP, but I mean, it's certainly worthy of discussion. I mean, I just find it a little hard, even if they spend millions and millions of dollars lobbying, it's difficult to see that being an outcome. Although you never know. Like, we've seen Trump and other people in his administration sort of discuss Made in America angle. And you could certainly imagine Ripple playing that up to their favor, saying that, like, Bitcoin is not American made, or I don't even know what the story there. I mean, it's complete nonsense, but it's just very difficult to imagine something created and controlled by one company would go into reserve. Obviously, I think it's pretty obvious to anyone who pays attention to the space that the United States or any country would be far better off having no reserve than a reserve that has XRP in it, unless they want Ripple, the company, to like have undue and outside influence over a country.
Right. Actually, the American-made thing is interesting because I hear that a lot as, like, narrative, but I don't think I've digested how are there like frameworks to thinking about how that would fit, how Bitcoin would or would not fit into that? Like, is there a version of this where blocks that have Coinbase rewards that are mined by miners who are based in the US, those Bitcoin maybe have a different treatment than Bitcoin that were maybe mined in China 10 years ago or something?
I think that would be like the approach that people would take that want to go with that angle. It's pretty nonsensical for a multiple. It's both nonsensical and bad for Bitcoin. I'll start with nonsensical. You know, so I think a person would say, well, the Bitcoin was made by the miner because it was, you know, new Bitcoin is minted with every block for now. And then so it was like made in America or made wherever. But that clearly doesn't last forever because like the minting of Bitcoin goes to zero. And then the only Bitcoin generated with mining is transaction fees. So it's not really making Bitcoin then. It's just collecting a fee. As far as, oh, and then also like sort of at the limit, Bitcoin mining would be private. So we don't even know who's mining a block, where the equipment's located. And that time will tell to what degree that's true. But that's certainly the idealistic version of Bitcoin is it's private. So then you wouldn't know where it's made. As far as like why it's not good for Bitcoin, fungibility is an incredibly important property of money. And if you start tagging or tainting Bitcoin with like, oh, this is like ESG friendly and this one's not, or this is made in America and this one's not, and the market starts pricing these Bitcoin differently, Bitcoin loses fungibility, that's not good money. Like just imagine going to a store and handing a $20 bill and then being told it's only worth $15 because it came from the wrong place or has the wrong, you know, history. So there's all kinds of reasons why I would strongly resist that notion. A related topic, I sometimes see people refer to the US dollar and fiat currency as public money and Bitcoin as private money. And I think I can like steel man their reasoning for that, but it's the opposite of my own instincts and what I believe. My steel man version for why I think they say that is like, well, the US dollar, the US government is elected by the people and, you know, it's in control of the money for the people. So the public, okay. You know, I buy that. And then because Bitcoin wasn't created or operated by an elected government, it's not public. That's where, I don't know, the logic seems to fall down a little bit for me there. Maybe there's a stronger argument for that. I don't know. But to me, Bitcoin is like nearly like perfection in terms of public. The entire system is public and transparent, free for anyone to use, inspect. I mean, it doesn't.
And voluntary participation, right? Like
voluntary participation. It doesn't inherently bias any particular group of people or country or affiliation. So it's like incredibly public. So calling it private sounds really ridiculous to me.
I think what you're pointing out there is actually something like much more important that I think very few people have grokked, which is the difference between state and public, or the difference between government and public, right? So I would actually just recategorize these things. So to me, a private money would be Ripple. And to be clear, for those who don't know, we can go further down this rabbit hole. I think the reason all of us are so ardently opposed to having something like this is that It's blockchain theater, right? It's marketing. It's this idea that, hey, it's a decentralized cryptocurrency, but it's all controlled on whatever one company's ledger effective. And that's the case for all cryptocurrencies, by the way, to differing degrees. Obviously, Ripple much more so and much more explicitly so than something like a Solana or something like an Ethereum. But at its core, that's the Bitcoiner's criticisms of all other cryptocurrencies, is they're all actually centralized. So that's why private money issued by a company being on the government's public balance sheet seems pretty corrupt, to say the least. On the other hand, you have this idea of what people call public money, but the truth is, and I think this is less nefarious. I think the Ripple thing is just pretty straight up nefarious. I think this is less nefarious and more a result of being a horse and buggy thinker when cars hit. This is just a result of being stuck in an old technological paradigm. In the past, government-based money or resources was the closest thing we had or could have to a public good, because that was the only infrastructure that could create or service public goods at scale. Other than, I guess you could maybe argue some kind of like, you know, charity or something like that. But at scale, especially for the state, a nation state level scale, that's the only way to do it. However, now that we're coming into the 21st century, there's a better and much more pure way to get what people say they want when they say public, which is to get rid of the state. And in getting rid of the state, you know, the way I've always thought about Bitcoin is that it's commons money or open source money. And so, and similarly for some of these other protocols we're interested in with things like Nostr, I think of Nostr as a commons for data, commons for identity. And all of these commons are really important because on top of that, you can build these incredible private companies and thriving, you know, markets, but you need that commons foundation. So I would just say for people that, that are hearing the difference between private and public money and thinking about the difference between should we have a company reserve? It's like Bitcoin is the only credibly neutral public good money, open source money out there, full stop, period. Anything else is either a grift by the state or a grift by a company, full stop.
I agree with that, but couldn't you say somebody a bit newer to learning about Bitcoin might say something like, well, why are you as a Bitcoiner telling us how innovation should happen? Shouldn't people be able to innovate in all kinds of different directions? Maybe there are new features that could be built to make better money. You know, there was MySpace before there was Facebook. How are you sure that this is the one?
Well, I would say two things. One thing just to start is I would say I'm not going to try and like control it, right? Free markets are going to free market. And we talked about this with the Trump administration last week, which is to say, do I like that he's out there creating Trump coin scamming? No. But like on the other hand, you know, I think in a free market, Bitcoin's going to win no matter what. Whether or not XRP and all these other things get on the balance sheet, it doesn't matter because truth will ultimately prevail. And I know I sound like I'm in a cult when I say that. So to answer the second part of your question, why do I say truth will ultimately prevail? Because at the end of the day, I mean, we could literally spend multiple episodes trying to explain the difference between Bitcoin and all these other, you know, blockchains. And there's actually a beautiful, I was talking with Drew at Unchained. He has some new work coming out explaining that it's not the blockchain that was like cargo culting. It's markets that matter. It's free markets. That's the whole point, you know, of what Bitcoin does. And what I would argue, the way I've always phrased this is that, and we've said this many times in the show before, to me, Bitcoin is energy back to money. It's the first time we've ever had a free market where you can trade computation cycles, which is effectively kilowatt hours or energy, for a native currency. And then you have markets that are built on top of that. Everything else is backed by nothing, full stop. And there's all these other points of, you know, there's not enough nodes and ecosystem and stuff that I know, Steve, we talked about this and maybe not the nodes themselves, but the economic nodes, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, for me, the simple point is Bitcoin was launched open source. There was no pre-mine. There was no company. And you can think of it more akin to a protocol like the internet or TCP/IP. Than you can to a company like MySpace. So I would say for people that have that MySpace evaluation, you're maybe just misidentifying what this is. It's not a company, it's a product.
I have a few thoughts as well to this hypothetical friend that you posed, David. So it depends on what we're talking about. Just like Max said, I'm a free market guy as well. So I'm not saying other projects can't exist, other experiments can't exist. I'm not at all. The more the merrier, sure. But I thought we were talking about the context of like what should go in the United States Strategic Reserve. And for that question, I'm going to put my American hat on.
Not like right.
My American hat. I'm an American and I think that's a bad decision for America. For the reasons we already said, like I think a private company, Ripple, that controls this quote token or money should not, I don't want, as an American, I don't want that in the strategic reserve. It really actually has nothing to do with Bitcoin. I'd just rather not have a strategic reserve. Yeah, that's my thoughts on it.
I agree.
Cool. So all of the discussion though on like what, you know, is it a crypto asset strategic reserve? Is it Bitcoin strategic reserve? Ultimately comes down somewhat to like how, you know, neutral it is and who owns it and how did it get launched and stuff like that, which touches a lot on the consensus ideas that, you know, Steve, your paper that you collaborated on in BCAP, is sort of designed to address how to think about the various interested parties, right? Like somebody who's new to this may look at it and be like, oh, you guys are all Bitcoiners. So of course you like Bitcoin. You kind of figured it out earlier than me. And so why
talking your books?
You're just talking your books, right? And the XRP guys talk in their books. Never you talk in their own book. And I think in a sense, I mean, fair, you know, that'd be like a fair criticism. But I think the question would be like, why are you talking your books? Like, how'd you decide that that's your book? And I think in the case of Ripple, they decided it's their book because they created it out of thin air. They created the ledger. They created the token. They sold it. They never bought it. They never did work. They never paid energy costs to produce it. They just like willed it into existence through, you know, a costless database transaction. But that's like, I think, starting to scratch the surface of this. It doesn't really get us into, you know, everything about how consensus works. It's like kind of just the starting point for consensus. So the BCAP project, I think it is it eight different categories of players?
Six. Why don't I summarize the project?
Yeah, why don't you give us...
Probably unfamiliar with it, but the project is an unsexy title, Bitcoin Consensus Analysis Project, BCAP, or BCAP. So I'm going to sound like BCAP.
It's like anti-clickbait.
Yeah, way easier to say. It's a project that Lynn Alden, Ren from Electric Capital, and myself worked on last year. The result was a 45-ish page paper, but it's a really good beginning to the analysis, but it's not the end. So it's an open source project that others have already been contributing to, and we welcome more contributors to keep it, to improve it over time and keep it fresh and relevant. The goal of it is to not to, it's not prescriptive. It's more observing. Like, why is it hard to change Bitcoin? Like, how can Bitcoin change, and why can't it? Or like, what prevents it from changing? I think it's a really interesting question because, I think the Bitcoin 101 pitch is like Bitcoin can't change. There can only be 21 million coins ever produced, and here's how they're produced, and no one else can produce any others. And that's huge. At a 101 level, that's a fine description. Telling someone that as an introduction, I think, is totally fine. But, you know, an intelligent question if you're learning is like, well, what, who's to say there can only be 21 million? Who, like, how does, what enforces that, right? And that opens up lots of interesting questions. And you basically get this 45-page paper, which begins to explain it. But even if you read through that, it gives you a much more advanced and sophisticated answer. But there's really no like perfect answer to this question, because it's there's a lot of game theory involved, and it's just a super complicated. When the XRP news has been talked about the last 2 weeks, it dawned upon me, like, you could write the consensus analysis for XRP in like a sentence. You know, Ripple, the company, decides how many there are, what the rules are, what the transaction rules are, etc. And there's really nothing. It's as simple as that. Just like whatever shows up on the google.com homepage is decided by, you know, you have Google, or like the company Google. And that's just simply not how Bitcoin works. As you mentioned, alluded to, David, there's, you know, we identified six different stakeholder groups. Even that, you know, you guys might think that you could come up with seven or five, or that can be debated. It's not in the rules that there's six groups. You can define it as 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Just the analysis of
arbitrary, but there's like a logic to why we chose those six. We chose the groups based on a couple factors. One is, what is a particular group's unique powers, and what are that group's motivation? And even that is not perfect, because like, it's not a homogenous group. Like, for example, one group is Bitcoin miners, and they don't all think the same things or behave the same way. So it's not a homogenous group, but in general, Bitcoin miners have certain powers that other groups don't have, and they have certain motivations that are distinct to their group. So each of these six groups, we feel like, are pretty distinct in their powers and their motivations. But what's fascinating is like, there's no one group that dominates. So not only is there like not one person or company or country that dominates, not even like one of these six stakeholder groups has unilateral control or power over Bitcoin. I'd say if there were one that has outsized power, it would be investors, the investor group, because the power investors have is they can buy and sell. And so if enough investors sell and there aren't corresponding buyers, well, what happens? The price goes down, right? And obviously, Bitcoin can handle the price going down. It's gone down 80-90% multiple times throughout its history. It survives. It comes back. But clearly, if like the price goes to like $10 for the next 50 years, that's a very different Bitcoin than what the one most people are imagining. And I don't say that just in terms of getting rich quick or something, even as a currency, in terms of number of people using it, the positive value in life, anything that you can imagine creating value in society or usage just necessitates a price higher than $10. So investors, I'd say, sort of have ultimate power. But if you look at the project and read through it, you can see how there's a lot of dynamics at play that their power is often sort of latent. It's sort of almost too late in many ways. So a lot of other groups have a lot of power as well. So
I wonder if you could...
super complicated, but other cryptocurrencies, much simpler one-pagers or one-sentencers. And I think that's just one way to help explain to newcomers the difference between what makes Bitcoin special and more decentralized than other projects.
If, just for analogy, so we could just think about this. Have you ever gone from like T equals zero and watched as your six categories emerge? Because like T equals zero, I'm saying, you know, right? Satoshi published a white paper. He started mining and started paying his energy bills in order to produce Bitcoin. But at that point, there wasn't like these six categories, or he was all six categories. And then little by little, I think like maybe category one got a little stronger and category two got a little stronger. Have you sort of gone through the sequence from T equals zero? Because I think I'm just, again, thinking about it in the notion of XRP. Like there was a day when XRP had a single ledger and they just created a bunch of stuff. And like with Satoshi, it was different because he was like losing his ability to control it as time went on. And I don't know, you know, from between day one and two, he probably still had most of the power, but like it kind of kept getting more diffuse. And I wonder almost like, can we trace that sequence in time a little bit?
Not exactly like you're describing. The project so far has looked at what you're saying for a specific change. And there was a consensus change to the rules of Bitcoin called SegWit. And the paper goes into that sort of timing sequence of different stakeholders for that, but not what you're saying. I think what you're saying is interesting. So you're welcome to open a PR and add it to the project. I think maybe what I'm reading into your question, though, is like the complexity described in the BCAP project wasn't all there on day one. It evolved over time. And so looking at how it evolved and how each of these categories were created, formed, grew, and how did they grow, you know, did they grow independently or interdependently? I think that's interesting. And then like, can that, maybe hidden in your question there is like, can other projects follow the same path? I think that would be a very reasonable question for someone new to the space.
What was the magic in that seat with Bitcoin? Like, for example, do we really need to have an immaculate conception?
Yeah. So I think, part of the answer certainly is we can look at fundamental properties of just the design of Bitcoin and the design of other projects that are objective differences that lead to an outcome where Bitcoin is more decentralized. That has been done. That can be done. We can cover it on this show if we want. And then how much of that is described by immaculate conception that Max just mentioned is, that's harder to like be.
Max and I are chuckling because we often invite people to participate in the chat, and we've inadvertently welcomed the XRP army.
The XRP army is here. Speaking of dead internet theory, now, one major idea that comes to mind as you say all of this, Steve, is, you know, I think this is awesome. And I haven't gone into all of the, like, the details of the paper because, as you said, it's very long. One thing that I think would be super valuable, you know, when you put on your American hat, I think the vast majority of people, and I would like to believe most legislators and politicians as well, like generally speaking, want to do what's right for America and for everybody else. Like ideally their incentives are aligned and they're interested in themselves. But generally speaking, I think most of them would like to do the right thing, right? I think the real challenge, what I've seen over a long time of talking to investors in this space, builders in the space who are very smart people, right? Let alone the people that haven't spent hours playing in cryptocurrency or whatever, is all the stuff you're talking about is amazing and true, but it's very abstract. It's very complex. for the average person, let alone the average regulator, is like 65 years old. Like, none of this makes sense, right? And so I wonder if there were just some way, you know, even like maybe a first starting point with like a graphic just to like show like whatever it is, did six different dimensions for each of the like whatever 10 candidates that people are discussing in a strategic reserve, and just break it down and show the difference between Bitcoin and each of them. One very simple example I used to look at when I was still investing in, you know, Ethereum and DeFi, you know, is I would basically say, like, how many projects, you know, do I know that would run their own node? And so in this case, it would be sort of economic nodes because these people are actually participating in the Ethereum network. And what shocked me was after like interviewing just dozens of these entrepreneurs back in 2020, 2021, is that the answer was exactly zero. And everyone was using Alchemy or Fura. And I was just like, what? Whereas in Bitcoin, every single company that I know runs at least one node. And so if there were just some way for people to wrap their head, even that one stat, I think if you just showed every single, you know, estimate, order of magnitude, economic nodes for each of these systems, and for Ripple, it's like one, I think that would have a pretty big impact.
And that's using the developers who are developing on those various platform or kind of protocols. You're saying if they were running their own nodes.
Correct.
Yeah. You're not talking about entrepreneurs, users, holders, et cetera.
Tons of like really famous projects. I just assumed. I was like, oh, like you're like one of the hottest projects in Ethereum. Like, of course you're running your own nodes. Now we're just like outsourcing that. And to me, and the reason is because, and you know, this is the thing that I would try and explain to people, you know, this is not exactly perfect, but this idea of two curves, the rate of growth of a blockchain, right? Which is, you know, how much data you're adding per year versus the cost of consumer hardware to run it. Like, i.e., if this is going up too fast and it's not getting cheap and easy to run a node, if it's too complex, then like they don't, that decentralization only gets worse over time. And that's why there was the 8 megabyte, you know, bloody war fought in 2017 in Bitcoin. Anyways, my point is all that's very abstract, but I feel like if regulators could go to like a simple website or like get a one pager that's just like, or if anyone's listening to this chat that is a designer or so, you know, inclined for this sort of thing, I do think most people would be like, shit, I don't want to put into our strategic reserve, you know, something where there's effectively one node run by one company. That seems like a scam.
I totally agree with you, Max, about finding simpler ways to describe it. But I think it's really, I've struggled to do so. I mean, even creating the BCAP project, it's like it's a complicated 45-page dense paper that even hardcore Bitcoiners struggle to like find the time to go through. I like your stat idea. Collecting that data is really hard though, right? It's not as simple as just looking at the number of nodes in the network, because that's actually a pretty weak statistic. You can easily Sybil attack that. I can spin up, you know, thousands of, you pick a coin, I can spin up thousands of nodes on AWS and it make it look better. But the specific metric you mentioned is a great metric. It's just hard to collect that data. Like, what percentage of like economic nodes, or that's just not the right, what percentage of like companies in the space run their own node versus outsourcing to someone else? And I think we both are quite confident it's a pretty high percentage in Bitcoin, and it's a pretty low percentage with other coins. But to have that be definitive proof and real-time data, I don't really know how to collect that.
Cool. I think we were adjusting some volumes. Maybe Max is leaving to rejoin with a new mic setup. But we were talking. Are you back now? Feeling good?
Yes, I saw in the chat that my my sound was really low on that tone, so I'm trying with just computer now.
Cool. Thanks for the feedback in chat. Yeah, if you have other kind of comments or questions, we'd love to hear it. We're always watching.
And let me make this sound better, by the way, whoever that was. Thank you.
Yeah. So Steve, we were talking some BCAP stuff. Any other points to summarize or stuff if we should touch on?
No, I mean, it's the kind of project we could talk about for a long time, but I think, you know, touching on it now is good, and in relation to the SBR.
Yeah. And I guess we
got some other good topics to go over.
Yeah. And I was going to say, we might get some news. I heard there's another round of executive orders being started in a couple hours from now. So this might be quickly outdated, or at least this is the news to watch the news.
Need something breaking. So, and I'll also just throw out there again on that point we were just discussing, to Steve's point, this is obviously very complex, similar to when we were talking about Lightning Network volume also being challenging because you need private company data. But if there is someone out there who's listening who is so inclined to figure out how to showcase this data of some, you know, whatever the different metrics are. But I think economic nodes per network would be a very good starting point. I think that would be super, super, super valuable. So just to reiterate.
Cool. Can we move on and talk a little bit about the stablecoin stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Stablecoins. So I've seen the headlines, but I don't know much about this. So I hope that you guys can sort of help tee it up a bit more. The headline I saw is that, I guess Tether, which is the largest stablecoin in the world, has been working with Lightning Labs, which I think is the creator of Taproot Assets, to issue USDT, so the Tether stablecoin, on top of Taproot Assets, so on top of Bitcoin. And then my understanding is it would be transactable via Lightning. So that's what I understand so far. But I, to be honest, I don't understand that. Oop, I got some echo there. So that's what I understand so far, but I don't really understand what Taproot Assets are. And I don't really understand how you issue USDT on Bitcoin. And I'd love to hear kind of if you guys can lay out a little bit of what that, like how that works or what that means, and then sort of weigh in on, is that good news? Is that bad news? Are you sort of excited about that or kind of skeptical?
Yeah, I can start at a high level. I'm not going to be a super expert on Taproot Assets. And BTC, by the way, thank you. I have adjusted my microphone volume. So if you hear that better, please let me know. Or if you don't, also let me know. So at a very high level, you know, Lightning Labs, first of all, shout out to them. Obviously, they've done a lot of work over the last decade in releasing to their private company, but a lot of incredible open source software with Lightning Network, with L&D. And, you know, one of the things I think they and a lot of us realized back in around 21, 22, which is when we were getting kind of the last big hype cycle around Bitcoin and Lightning Network, was that, yeah, you know, Lightning Network is great, but most people, for a variety of reasons, still don't want to use Bitcoin for payments. Obviously, I know we've talked about this ad nauseum an earlier episode. So if you want to hear more about that, Steve has had some great points about, you know, Bitcoin is increasing as a payment mechanism, specifically using the Lightning Network. Awesome. Glad to see that the volume is now working better. Thank you, BTC. Another example of a little dynamic feedback loop here. This is great. But what they did realize back then, and this has only become much, much truer since then, is that stable coins do have product market fit. You know, we can shit on the centralized networks like Ethereum and Tron and Solana all day long, and I will. But I also have to give them credit that they found one major product market fit outside of gambling for their networks. And that product market fit was because they're Turing complete smart contracting language and protocols, they can, you know, create stable coins on top of those networks. And I don't know what the last number was, but I mean, we're, I think, in like mid-teens trillions of dollars, like some huge, huge number of stable coins that are now moving on these networks. Back then, it was large, but it's just exploded since then. And so Lightning Labs basically was like, okay, well, you know, the Lightning Network is amazing for many reasons, not just because, you know, it uses Bitcoin, this asset that we all know and love, but also because it's the only peer-to-peer routed final settlement, instant final settlement network in the world. I think that deserves its own, you know, really, really pause. The Lightning Network is the only payment network in the world where you can get instant final settlement almost for free. And the reason for that is that the Lightning Network is not a blockchain. So I think this is something really critical to understand. When people say we need a blockchain for that, what they're really saying is we need global state. We need lots of computers, lots of nodes to share the same state of the world, the same ledger, if you will, of whatever the native asset is or dollars, whatever. And we need them all to be in sync. Now, just like zooming 20,000 feet out, even if you totally sacrifice centralization, so you go full blockchain theater to make your system work fast, like Solana, you still need all those different nodes in the network to sync up for the blockchain, which is why Solana often goes down. And I don't know how many nodes are on Solana now, 10, 20, whatever it is, they still have to sync up. And so they are ultimately restricted by physics, the speed of light. You still need to send information that syncs up to all of these different nodes in the network, full stop. You can never get instant final settlement on Solana, full stop. It's much faster than all the other blockchains because they're theatrics. They're not real block. They're not actually decentralized. But the Lightning Network can eat Solana and every other centralized company's lunch, other than maybe Ripple, because it's just like one computer. So if you're just like complete theatrics, then okay. But in that world, the reason for that is because it's a peer-to-peer network. So interestingly, the Lightning Network is very similar to Tor, and it uses something called onion routing, which basically means you can have, call it 15 hops. Let's say I want to pay Steve. And in order to do that, I only know the first hop, which goes to DK, and then DK sends it to 10 other people. But each of those next hops on the network are hidden in such a way that I can't even see what the route is. Or I maybe can't see the route as the guy sending the payment, but the guy receiving the payment can. Whatever. The point is, because it's a bunch of peer-to-peer hops in the network, you can get instant final settlement. So I could send an instant payment to Steve. That's the beauty of the Lightning. That's the beauty of peer-to-peer built on top of Bitcoin. Now, obviously the challenge is people want stablecoins, and it makes sense why people want stablecoins. People want stablecoins for all kinds of reasons. One is for basically you want value that's not going to go up or down a whole bunch in a day. You might do that because you're a trader and maybe you're, you know, trying to move money between different exchanges and you want to be able to hold and know more or less, even if, you know, US inflation is pretty bad, it's not going to, you know, dramatically change one day to the next or even one month to the next, at least we hope. And so that's one reason. It also has incredible brand and network effects. You know, the kind of joke is that as countries start dumping their treasuries on their own from their central banks, it's the retail, the people in those countries that know the dollar, that store in the dollar. Everyone in Mexico, cash under the mattress, dollars. Everyone in Africa, cash under the mattress, dollars. Same with Southeast Asia, everyone. So there's certainly demand to store in dollars because of that brand, and that's not going to die overnight, even if Bitcoin continues to succeed. So all of that said, what that leaves us with is we have a very powerful piece of new technology and a payment network, the Lightning Network, that allows for peer-to-peer final settlement, instant final settlement. We also have a massive demand for dollar volume that can move globally around the world, much less regulated. But the problem is those two things were impossible before. Because Bitcoin doesn't have the Turing complete language, you couldn't create these stable coins on top of Bitcoin the same way you could on top of Ethereum, Solana, Tron, whatever. Excuse me, I got a little too excited. So the question becomes, is there a way that you can issue stable coins on top of Bitcoin with the restrictions that are there in its current scripting environment? Maybe that changes over time, but let's say with where we are today, that can take advantage of the Lightning Network. And the answer, you know, at least the Lightning Labs proposed, is yes, using Taproot, which was a big consensus change a couple of years ago. And Steve, I'm sure, can talk way more about that and you know, some of the technicals of how that worked. But the gist of it is, you know, I kind of think of it as like in the same way, this is probably like a very oversimplified version, but in the same way you like roll a whole bunch of things up in a Merkle tree, it's kind of like you can roll a whole bunch of different assets and transactions up into one UTXO in Bitcoin and have all of those represent, you know, some of their asset like dollars. And so the beauty of this then is if it works and you can issue dollars that can move on top of the Lightning Network, then you get a whole bunch of incredible benefits. Number one, you get the ability to send a dollar with instant final settlement for almost free anywhere in the world. That's extremely powerful. And we know that no other blockchain can ever compete with that. Number two, you get access to the liquidity, which is dominant of Bitcoin, because in the underneath the Lightning Network, you're basically paying all fees for this movement in Bitcoin. And you get native integration with wherever Bitcoin and Lightning has been integrated, which at this point is every major exchange. One detail that I forgot to mention is, the way that this works is you can basically run in, you know, this version of the world, you can run edge nodes where, you know, when you're routing payments, you're not just routing a Lightning Network payment, but you're routing a specific asset type payment on top of the Lightning Network. So in this case, it could be a stable coin with Tether. Now, to be fair, you know, there are a lot of criticisms. There's no guarantee that this specific design is going to work. Number one, it's taken many years. A lot of people have been waiting very patiently, and it's amazing that it's finally here. Two, there's question, you know, it's potentially very challenging to go between different asset types. I think that can be solved later on. But the big news here to me is that their launch partner for this is Tether. Now, I don't know how committed Tether is to making this work, but the fact that their CEO, Paolo, was on stage with Elizabeth and our mutual buddy, Brian Murray, which was awesome to see. Because as we know, you've got other craft investors shilling Solana and XRP. So it's great to see someone from that firm working on Bitcoin. But if they are really committed to this, Tether is by far the most important company in the space. I mean, I think their print yesterday was what, $14 billion of profit last year. They are the dominant, you know, stablecoin provider. So their volume alone could be all you need if they're really committed to making this work and they hook up the Taproot channels to Bitfinex and all these other places. Will that happen? Who knows? And there's a lot of other companies and projects that are taking different approaches to this. Spark from LightSpark is a very different approach. You've got the ARC approaches. You've got eCash happening in Australia. And so I'm definitely not saying this is the one that's going to win, but to me, this is exciting if for no other reason than one, it gives the Lightning Network, in my mind, a big jolt in the arm for people to realize, oh yeah, the thing that we know we need, which is to be able to tap into this massive product market fit around stable coins, is at least being endorsed in what seems like an excited way by the most powerful company in the space. So
can we talk a little bit about just what would it mean? How would I, as kind of a naive end user, be able to use that thing? Let's say I live in Africa or something and I want to save in USD stable coins, and I don't really care if they're on Solana or Bitcoin or whatever, but oh, there's like a way to do it on Bitcoin. Great. Like, how does that show up in front of me? Is that an app that I download?
Is wallet, and you can send and receive dollars and save in dollars.
And does that wallet, does that exist already? Or that's a wallet that can be built now that we have Taproot, Lightning, etc.?
I don't believe wallets exist yet.
Okay, so this was like an announcement that it's going to happen.
Well, there are some
that they're going to mint, that Tether will mint dollars on Taproot assets.
Is it true that once Tether has minted those dollars that they can't really control them anymore? Like, do they have the ability to rescind or restrict the issuance?
That's, I have several thoughts on this topic, both an additional like area that I'm excited about beyond what Max said, but also I have a bunch of concerns/questions to be asked as well, including kind of riffing off what you just asked, David. Can I start with like the one thing that I think is potentially exciting about it? I should say the one thing. I mean, in addition to what Max said, another thing that's exciting about Taproot assets, like a problem that exists with stable coins on other blockchains. Like if you take USDC as an example, within the Ethereum ecosystem, there's USDC issued on Ethereum, on Base, on Polygon, and a number of other like platforms, and none of which are compatible with each other. And David, you and I, when we were experimenting with this, we ran into this problem. Like, I had USDC on Base and you had it on Ethereum, and we couldn't exchange with each other. So it's a horrible user experience for a variety of reasons. One thing that Taproot Assets could do is just hide all that. Kind of like Bridge.xyz was acquired for like $1 billion by Stripe. Kind of like that, but just inherent in the protocol. So if I have, one asset, I mean, let's say I have like dollars and you live in London or something, you want to receive pounds, then when I'm sending it over the Lightning Network using Taproot assets, there can be swap providers at the edge on both ends. And all that's just hidden from you and me as the users. Very much like Strike has worked for 3 or 4 years in a more proprietary fashion, but Strike absolutely works that way. I've used it before in Ghana, where I paid for a restaurant bill using like their mobile money. All I had was the Strike app on my phone with my US dollar bank account attached to it. And I was able to make a payment that they received as mobile money in their own local currency. It was really beautiful experience. So you can do that with Taproot assets. I think that's an enormous win. Here are some questions/concerns. And I say questions because maybe my concerns are ill-founded. Maybe there's good answers to this. So I just don't know yet. But it's questions we should be asking to learn more. And one is to address what you asked, David. Tether over time, a lot of people view Tether as like this like black market, like scam or whatever. And I think over time, more and more people are seeing it has like real backing. They're one of the largest buyers of US treasuries in the world. So I think it being an outright scam is near 0% probability now. I mean, is it a full reserve? For a number of years, I've thought it's a high probability it's a full reserve. I still don't know if we have like perfect auditability to know that, but like pretty good confidence there. But what we've also definitely observed with Tether over time is that they are more compliance friendly with the United States, which makes sense. Like Max said, they're printing money, $13, $14 billion profit last year. So why do things that are going to put you in jail? Why not?
And to be clear, that profit
and make $13 billion a year, right? I mean, so it makes sense that they follow the law.
And to be clear on where that profit comes from, it's the yield that they generate on the treasuries that they buy, that they don't give that yield to the holder of the USDT.
Yeah, I think 8 billion of the 13, I think it was 13. 8 of the 13 was from that. And then 5 was from appreciation of other assets they hold, like Bitcoin.
Which, by the way, even if they weren't fully reserved at any point, now that they're like stacking whatever 20-30% of their profits in Bitcoin, at least, this could be one of the most important companies ever.
So, but the, I guess that
it's also captured.
Yeah. So it's, there's more and more evidence of being, they've frozen a lot of assets that the US asked them to. And that's not a criticism. It's just reality. I mean, it's just a natural
company. That's the business. Yeah.
If any of us were running a company, we don't want to go to prison. So we would do that, just like Coinbase and Lock and other companies do. So they're doing that. My question / concern with Taproot assets is I don't know how you can freeze Tether on Taproot assets. So maybe the answer is yes, you can, but I'm not aware.
Is it easy to freeze on the other chains where it exists?
Yes.
Yeah. And Tether's done it. It's demonstrated. So if it's not possible, then that to me is like a huge looming question of how it would even evolve. If it is possible, okay, great. I mean, and then that gets into highlighting some differences between Bitcoin and stablecoins as well. I mean, I think even with that power, stablecoins are obviously demonstrating they have lots of product market fit and value to the world, even if Tether's freezing some things that the U.S. believes is criminal activity. But that would be one question I'd have. Another would be, I just mentioned this exciting opportunity with Taproot assets where you can swap between assets and all that sort of like hidden from the end user. Hidden in some, I mean, there's going to be some kind of fee that someone has to pay, probably the customer, because there needs to be providers that are providing that liquidity and the swapping. You know, is that going to be, are regulators going to be looking at that? Are they going to like require KYC? I suspect so, but it's another open question. And if they require KYC, then that is a very different experience and use cases that can and cannot be served. And so I'm not sure what the future holds for that as well.
Just one comment on the last one. On the first one, I'm not sure. I assume they can do the freezing. I mean, like they can certainly like tag what they're issuing onto the chain. But I guess once it's like being moved around, I assume they could like mark the Tether in such a way that it's like, yeah, this one that we issued, we know is associated with this person. So that's at least blacklisted in some way, shape or form. But I don't know. If someone's listening in the chat, maybe they can answer that question better. By the way, I'm not saying I'm a fan of that. It's just a reality. To be clear, I think all of us would agree, you know, we would love to see everyone using Bitcoin natively. I think, you know, in 100 years time, there's only one currency left. It's Bitcoin, full stop. But like the reality is it takes generations, things to evolve, brands die hard. And this allows all that activity that's on other chains to at least move back to Bitcoin and generate Bitcoin fees for the network and all kinds of other, I think, generally good things. But it's not saying it's without risk. Yes, there's also some people, to be clear, that would argue this is a Trojan horse from the state to try and, you know, start more Bitcoin movement. And this is one way to do that. So all those criticisms are there. Your second criticism, I was for a while pretty bearish on, and I know for a fact, I know very sophisticated people that were starting to, you know, that were running Lightning nodes and that were starting to do, thinking about doing Taproot, basically exchange, so running nodes at the edge of the network that, you know, could serve dollars. And as we started seeing more fear, I guess about 18 to 12 months ago around running Lightning nodes and needing to KYC your customers, you saw companies pulling out of the US for custody, things like that. I saw people get a lot more skittish on that. And I was, to be frank, kind of bearish for, I guess, whatever year that would have been, 2023 or 2024. However, it does seem like now, you know, with the new administration, who knows? And I think if there's a time for this to pop off and you know, sort of an environment for that to grow in, it's probably a much, you know, if they're open to, you know, allowing scam coins like Ripple out there, that's the bad news. The good news is they're probably also not going to try and squash, you know, trading on edge nodes and Lightning Network. So maybe that's the regulatory environment that's needed to, you know, to plant that seed.
But I mean, if we have something that's so tightly controlled and so much volume operating on Bitcoin, does it actually hurt the underlying protocol to some extent? I mean, is that a big concern or not much of a concern?
It's definitely
like, does the taproot piece
analysis and discussion. I don't know. I mean, there's other examples of Meevil that aren't this, but are definitely concerning. Whether this introduces Meevil, I don't know. But something to pay attention to, though, is if operators running edge nodes attract regulatory scrutiny because they're running Taproot assets, that could be bad for Bitcoin payments if it wouldn't have otherwise attracted regulatory scrutiny. So like if it's just an edge node that is purely Bitcoin and Lightning payments and that's it, and regulators were fine with that, but then all of a sudden you add this additional functionality where you can swap between millions of different assets and basically run like Uniswap on that edge node, and that does attract regulatory scrutiny, that could be bad for Bitcoin payments. You know, I don't think
any when you say edge node, is that that's like a Lightning node with extra functionality?
Is that it's like what a wallet connects to? I mean, they literally called it edge node in their announcement, but I mean, the general concept works too. It's the node that your wallet connects to, also known as LSP, ASP. There's lots of different types of edge nodes. ASP would be like an ARC service provider, and LSP is a Lightning service provider, but it's the liquidity provider that connects to a wallet.
And the good news is, I mean, you know, I don't know about good news. Like, to be clear, I'm kind of like Steve on this. Like, in some ways, I'm really excited because I would love to step on and come back to Bitcoin. In other ways, I'm cautious with this because, like, yeah, I don't think anyone knows, right? There's people, if you go to Stacker News right now, you know, you've got the dark coins of the world, basically. You know, I think you can probably guess what their opinion is on this, that this is a state attack. And maybe it is. Who knows? On the other hand, you know, there's a lot of opportunity to onboard a ton of users that are already using dollars. Like, imagine, you know, one other really, I think, nice analogy for people to think about is I've always thought of Bitcoin and the layers that come on top of Bitcoin is the internet of value. Solana, Ethereum, all of these other, you know, Base. I'm shocked you even have Base. I'm curious in what context that was happening, but all of these centralized blocks.
Even I like to learn. Okay. We're very curious. Like we play with the tool.
Prior to us chatting on Fridays with DK and I would just privately like experiment with stuff.
Okay. Steve isn't going to tell us about his secret soul stash, his strategic reserve.
Can't imagine my Trump coin bags.
Fob. I knew there was some closet shitcoiners here. But, you know, each of those, and you guys said yourself, they're not interoperable. That's the problem. So I think if each of those, like in the long arc of history, when the story about this generation is written, Bitcoin, internet, everything else, intranet. And we've seen how this story plays out. So, the bull case for Taproot assets or something like it is it plugs all of this real world demand and real world money and real world GDP into the internet, which makes the internet grow even faster. Meanwhile, the intranets die, just like they did last time. But yeah, but in, you know, 25 years, and it's something else I think about, you know, you made a point, Steve, when you were discussing the BCAT thing, and I go back and forth on this. I think it was a paper from Wences some years ago. Maybe 2019 or something, where he was kind of discussing his probabilities. He published this publicly somewhere, but his probabilities for what was going to happen to Bitcoin, you know, the like 70% probability or whatever it was, 60% probability was it's going to become the new global reserve currency and everything is going to move there. The like 5-10% probability was it just dies. And then there was this other like middle ground, which is like 20-30% probability. It's like, well, it doesn't die. The price is probably pretty low. Maybe it's $1,000. Maybe it's $10,000. But that's it. And like, it's there. It survives in the same way that like, you know, torrents and sites like that, they're there. They're never going to die. But like all the volume went to Spotify and to YouTube and to all the paid services. And so that's one way I think about this is like, and I'm curious how you guys would answer this. Like if you had to do the analysis, maybe the reality is to go mainstream if you want to serve everyone in the world is like, you know, it feels kind of like selling out a little bit, or it feels like it's kind of dangerous. You feel like you're going through this Spotify and YouTubeification. But the other route, if you say it's cypherpunk, is like, yeah, it's there, but like, you know, only like extremely high-end experts use it, and they use it in a way that's kind of like, you know, I don't know, like dangerous to them. And I don't know. It's a tough question. I think we're certainly, if I were reweighting his probabilities, much higher towards Bitcoin swallowing up everything. But I don't know. I don't know if you guys have any reaction to that.
David?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't think the asset, like just the capital asset of Bitcoin is going away. And so even if the Lightning stuff gets subsumed by mostly USDC stablecoin or USDT stablecoin activity, like maybe that's part of a generational transition. Maybe that gives people a lot of exposure. But like, even if that were the case and everything were kind of like the Spotification and YouTubification of that, I mean, I'd almost rather see people kind of, you know, understanding these new technologies, learning how these wallets work, some sense of what it means to custody, you know, ownership in a capital asset or payments, even if it ends up taking a long time for kind of native payments, you know, not kind of uncontrolled, unissued payments to work. Like it may just be part of the transition that we need, you know, to get to where, you know, to get to where everybody's using this. Like I guess the worst would be if nothing changes at all and we just say like, it's more of the same. The last 100 years, we're just going to replay for the next 100 years. To me, that seems like maybe the worst outcome of all. I'd almost rather, you know, innovation flourish and people try new things and we see what hits and what serves people's needs. But I don't think like the capital asset of Bitcoin is likely to get super corrupted by this, but it may either accelerate or decelerate the need or the use of things like native Lightning or maybe some of the eCash proposals that we've seen.
I'm smirking because we're getting more audience question or comment that XRP the standard. Related to that, I've noticed I have gained a few more followers recently on X that are from profiles that seem they're not the typical profile that would follow me in the past. More Web3 and other coins and stuff. So I don't know if that means we're killing it on this show or like really, but maybe they're learning a little bit more about Bitcoin from us.
Seems bad.
I wanted to say one more thing about Taproot Assets and the Lightning Network, just to make sure everyone understands. Like, there'll be a lot of currency. Taproot Assets enables tokenization of things. So in theory, you could have thousands of new tokens created, stablecoins being, you know, one that we think is legitimate, and then a bunch of like, you could create meme coins, you could create, you know, fractional real estate tokens, you could create any kind of tokens you want. Now, Max mentioned earlier, like his 101 of how the Lightning Network works, David might be sending me something and it goes through 10 different other Lightning nodes to reach me. Now, if David wasn't sending me Bitcoin, but instead sending me this a fractional reserve share of his home, every node in that network needs to understand that asset. Or that's not true, and just the edge nodes do. And if just the edge nodes do, then they would convert that fractionalized real estate token into Bitcoin, send it over the network to my edge node or the edge node I'm connected to. It would convert it back to the fractionalized David's home token. And then my wallet would receive it. So,
By the way, this is sort of a good way to think about this is the same way the internet works, right? Like the foundation of the internet doesn't know if you're watching a YouTube stream. You know, it's just like a packet, right, that gets encapsulated and flows through and then gets unwrapped on the edge.
What kind of other packet were you thinking of, TK?
I think I missed something. Was that in the chat?
Just giving you time for your suggestions the last couple of weeks, what built the payment network.
So one type of network that can be built out doesn't have swapping at the edges, but just literally, like, let's say USDT on Taproot Assets becomes dominant, like billions of dollars of minted tokens and tens of billions of volume or whatever, the whole network could just support that and there's no swapping. It would work just like Bitcoin is transferred on Lightning Network. So that's a possible future as well. So I think it'll be interesting to see how does that play out? Like, what are all the wallets that adopt this? And then how much of the volume is from edge node swapping versus like some very popular dominant tokens being very, you know, having widespread adoption throughout the node.
And I just threw it in the chat, by the way. There is one wallet that's been testing this for a while that I know of, at least SpeedApp. These guys are out of India. interestingly, they had already got, they as a test, obviously they had Bitcoin on the Light Network, and as a test, created their own USDT sort of like custodied version. So I think they bought it on whatever, Ethereum, Tron or something, and then minted their own version. That's, you to trust them again with the one-to-one peg, blah, blah, blah. But at least there are examples of this in the wild.
I don't know if you guys have talked at all to Paolo. I haven't talked to him about this, but my understanding is he's a very strident Bitcoiner. And I wonder if sort of given the impact that they have on issuance across various chains and kind of the influence they have with exchanges, if it's likely that they're going to put a lot of marketing muscle behind this and sort of, in a sense, if they see this as the interoperable future, if they would be taking moves with all of their deep capital base to kind of direct the activity of a lot of the other chains to do this. Do you guys have a sense that that's part of the incentive that they would be following or not?
Without a doubt. I mean, and that to me, I mean, so it remains to be seen how committed they actually are to this. But that to me is the big story, is like the fact that, you know, this was done at their event, Plan B and El Salvador. You know, it was like the main thing with Paolo on stage with Elizabeth. Like, I mean, to be fair, they've had a lot of different experiments. Like I believe Tether was like largely funding RGB and some of these other competitive things that never really took off. And, you know, they're, I'm sure also, look, they have a lot of money, right? Like their tentacles are, I'm sure they're funding and supporting all kinds of projects. But if they really do see this as the future and they really put their weight behind it, I don't think it's going to launch on day one in Bitfinex, but like I would imagine it will take that much longer to be up and running there. That to me is the story, is like Tether can be a kingmaker here. Will they? I don't know. But this seems like a good first step.
It's another data point that suggests they're keen on bringing Tether back to Bitcoin. They've invested in Tether on Lightning in other ways as well. They have an active project for RGB. RGB is an open source project that predates Taproot assets and in many ways is similar to Taproot assets. It allows tokenization on top of Bitcoin, and that project uses LDK as the Lightning network. But so there is a project. I don't know exactly the status or future, especially in light of like yesterday's announcement, but they've been investing in that as well.
I haven't heard much. I mean, heard the name RGB before, but is that, did it kind of fade from the mainstream consciousness, or never got really started?
And to be super clear on all that, I mean, I obviously, you know, whatever bias, I don't know them that well anymore. So, but you know, don't want to like talk badly about them. But I remember I met the RGB guys like 2020, and it's like been years and years and nothing shipped. And they were all mad. Oh, Lightning Labs kind of like jacked some of our ideas for Taproot. And again, to be fair, then Lightning Labs took forever to ship too. So it's been kind of frustrating weight on all fronts. I think the one thing that we're all clear on is, number one, Tether guys are Bitcoiners. That's for sure. We know they're stacking Bitcoin with their Tether profits. Like they've been very publicly outspoken. The founders, the CEO, like they're Bitcoin maximalists, full stop. So that's a fact. And to Steve's point, they definitely want stablecoin volume to come back to Bitcoin Lightning. And they've had many different, you know, experiments. I think some other ones, well, they may not even be bubbled in that. That's a fact. But to me, this announcement, I mean, it seems like a good first step, that this is one they're going to throw away behind, but only time will.
And to speculate, like if you're them, like why do you want it on Bitcoin? Well, here would be my reasons. You know, like right now Tether on Tron dominates, and Tron has been, it's been cheap to transfer. Like probably no one else, I would guess, no one uses Tron for anything other than Tether on Tron. But, you know, if you fast forward 20 years, 30 years, what's the probability that Tron's going to still be around? I don't know. But, like, I think the probability that Bitcoin's going to be around in 20 or 30 years is, like, you know, 100%. Or, like, just shy. 99.999%. Where Tron is not that. Tron's much, much, you know, most of the other, getting back to like centralized versus decentralized, most of the other projects are far more centralized, much closer to like a company, including Solana. And Solana has a lot of attractive characteristics, just like a lot of companies create products that have a lot of attractive characteristics. But what's the probability that any given company is going to be around in 30 years? And that's a similar type of probability assigned to some of these platforms. So if you're trying to create something that's durable and enduring, putting it on Bitcoin, you don't have to worry about that. And also, I mean, Tether has a history of, they've gone from, you know, they were on Bitcoin originally using Omni, then Ethereum, then Tron, and then I think they have on Solana as well, and now back to Bitcoin. So they keep moving around, they adjust. That's probably not something they love either, because it fragments their own issued coin and creates bad UX, and probably, and it creates liquidity issues. I mean, a bunch of major drawbacks. So they probably would love to just be on a platform that they know they need to stick with for the next, you know, many decades.
I think it's also fair to say, you know, without knowing these guys super well or anything, but like my understanding is they're also ideological, right? Like at the end of the day, like they want to see Bitcoin succeed. They want freedom to win. As a small announcement, you know, we could spend more time on this. So I think there's one bigger story to cover, but they also, I think down there, were doing the announcement of integrating the huge investment Rumble, and now we're allowing sort of Bitcoin, and I guess through this also USDT payments eventually on Lightning on that platform as well. So these guys, to be clear, you know, obviously I'm sure they're very, very savvy businessmen. Clearly they are, but it does appear that there's also some amount of just myth in here too. The thing that I want to make sure we touch on briefly, because I don't think we can't not touch on this week, is there was a huge release from, there was a major development in the AI world. Now, the way that I would couch this is, if you had told me 1 to 2 years ago that we would be getting free AI for everyone, and it was going to be provided by a Chinese hedge fund, while an American nonprofit was charging $200 a year for very similar technology, I might not have believed you. In fact, I probably wouldn't have. So I think it's at least worth mentioning DeepSeek. You know, it's been out for a while, but for whatever reason, this is the week it really shook everyone's mind. People realized, holy shit, we can get reasoning models, and we can get infinite free API calls, it seems, although I think you should be careful with the API. You could run the model yourself. It's free. I think this is big for a number of reasons, including, you know, what can be built in the future with Noster, Bitcoin, and stuff on top of it. But I think the first thing, just one thought I'll share, and I'm curious your thoughts, is, you know, it remains to me very unclear how the markets are going to go in the AI world. On the one hand, you've got open source commoditized AI getting free. And so I totally buy that, you know, most tasks for people are going to be stuff that you can just run local, right? Like, it's not complex. Like, we're already at that state. So in that state of the world, I'm very bullish on companies. This is not investment advice. It's just me like speculating, but on companies like Apple or Google that own Android, you know, because if you can just do the inference on device, amazing. And then very complex things go to the cloud. Similarly, at the same time, though, we talked, I don't even know if we talked last week, Stargate, you know, $500 billion commitment, building these giant clusters, Elon going all in on building the biggest clusters. That's kind of like the opposite direction, saying, no, actually, we're going for the God models. We believe we can create ASI and all that stuff, and maybe they will. And, you know, I would never bet against Elon. But to me, I guess the broader point, the implication here is like kind of unclear where the world's going to go. I mean, I think the market's overreacted, but people selling off whatever 20% in NVIDIA in one day seems crazy to me. And I think there's, it's what's that dude? Jevons paradox, or like the cheaper stuff gets, the more you're going to use. Like, I think there's going to be constant demand for GPUs and all that. But I think the interesting thing to me is just like in this world where things are changing so quickly, companies are coming, like rising, falling so quickly, assuming public private key cryptography doesn't get broken or we're able to change it, man, Bitcoin sure looks like a good investment versus everything else.
Yeah.
Is a curveball. I did not know that. Yeah. Bitcoin hook.
I thought you were going to conclude the XRP army.
Not investment advice at all.
I do feel like...
He's already changed. Oh, shit.
I do think the world, you know, I feel like there's a chaotic energy online today, which is almost like hard to pair with coffee because it's already so jittery. Feels like every day there's some huge banger, some huge big move that drops. And, you know, when I first saw DeepSeek, it was actually on Inauguration Day, and I tweeted it not cheekily at all. I said, like, this is like the biggest news of the day or something, because I thought it was like pretty exciting that something, you know, fully open, fully just sort of a gift to the world was given. And it's basically at state of the art level. So I think it's just an indication that even if there is a frontier of, you know, great work, CapEx, you know, huge models, big teams, et cetera, pouring into this, you know, so far the evidence is, I mean, I feel like this was predictable, but so far the evidence seems to be that it's all going to be available to everybody everywhere very quickly, which I think as somebody who loves software and loves the internet, I think is a great news for me as like an end consumer, because it kind of means that, you know, it used to be that software was a great business because it was expensive to create software. You have to be or hire teams of highly qualified, well-trained individuals to write the software. That takes a lot of hard work. And the magic is you invest that up front and then you get to sell it millions or billions of times and you don't have any marginal cost on selling all the work you put in up front. And I think what we're seeing now is that the cost of production should go to about zero. We're not there yet, but like you can play with some of these tools, like, you know, Replit Agent is a great example. You know, there's V0 and Lovable and Cursor, and there's a lot of tools that are emerging that are going to further drive down the cost to create. Doesn't mean that software engineers are going to be unemployed all of a sudden. I think there's plenty of opportunities at more frontier stuff, you know, for quite a long time. I don't think we're close to the end of that. But if software gets to be roughly free and everybody can dream up whatever they want and they can just like will a piece of software into existence, then I think the cost of everything in software is going to go down. We're seeing this already. Like there's early teams that I meet that get to $10 million plus dollars in revenue with a team of under a dozen people. And they don't require a lot of investment up front, and they can create tremendous value for people with like almost no investment. I think that's just going to keep accelerating. And so we're going to see things that basically, you know, you will into existence and you get exactly what you want and you don't have to pay for it. But like in that world where it's chaotic and it's like, is NVIDIA going to accrue the value? Is OpenAI, is DeepSeek going to come out of left field? Is Google, like these things, it feels like they're just going to continually be a race. Nobody controls anything in a sense. And everything kind of becomes free. And in that world, I'm like, well, if everything kind of is becoming free, maybe save rockets and like the really frontier hard tech hardware moving, you know, atoms around the world. But if software and networks are all free, it kind of makes me say like the only thing that I would want to own is like the information service that is, you know, the thing that's limited and scarce. Nothing else looks as good to me as owning the thing that's scarce. So that's kind of how I come to, I think, a similar conclusion. Like, I think similar conclusions that you're saying, Max, but as much as AI is crazy exciting for everything, I don't even know what the bet is there versus the bet on Bitcoin just becomes more obvious and stronger because it is limited. It is scarce. There's only one. There's not like, you know, another innovative competitor nipping at the heels. It just is.
I mean, a spin on that is like AI agents will want to get paid or they might need to pay other AI agents. And, if AI also concludes Bitcoin is the best money, what are they going to want to demand when getting paid? They're going to demand Bitcoin and not fiat currency. So I think the really interesting intersection here is with the growth of AI and AI agents and how the economy within AI, to me, seems like it could be the explosion of Bitcoin payments that we've all been hoping for.
Yep. Yeah, it's not about buying coffee. It's about what the agents need. Because the agents, every time an agent looks and they say, I really want to collect money, let me check out the account sign up form on Jace.com. And then it asks for a social security number. The agent's like, I don't have a social security number. How do I do this? Whereas in Bitcoin, you literally just do the math and generate the key and you have it. And an agent can do that math and generate the key. It doesn't have to ask somebody for permission to create an account for me, create a password for me. Here's my social security number and address, because they don't have those things. So it's like, it's the only one that actually empowers a non-human to hold value.
Totally. And I think we're going to see that all explode a lot this year. I mean, I wrote my piece, highmind.vc/AI. Here, that was a couple of years ago. I talked a little about this. I think it was too early. But I think finally this year is the year we're going to start to see a lot of this kind of play out a bit. But I think in my mind, so in that world where, you know, you said this many times, the way you say, I like this, DK, that software becomes disposable, right? So in a world where software becomes disposable, and what is still scarce in that world? Well, human attention, for sure. That's still valuable. Potentially Bitcoin, which you can think of in some ways, and I'm not saying this is all good or bad, but just like kind of an objective analysis of, you know, kind of value going from labor to capital in a sense. And it's just kind of, I think, kind of sucked into capital. And if you think Bitcoin is the sort of singularity of capital. Okay, that's all going to go there. To your point, Steve, as the amount of transaction volume picks up heavily, and I think people are completely underpricing and underappreciating this, where when we think about volume and Lightning, say like, oh, maybe one day we're going to hit Visa on Lightning. No, dude, we're not going to hit Visa. We're going to hit like 1,000 Visas or 10,000 or a million Visas. And that's because when you have computers, there's 8 billion humans. What happens when we have 80 trillion agents and they're doing transactions way faster than we can even imagine? And all of that, if it's happening in the Lightning Network, the other company you want to own there, or the company I would like to own there, is, you know, who's routing for the AI? That space on the Lightning Network that's still accruing fees for doing the routing, that's still scarce. Scarce in the sense that you still want the well-connected node that can, you know, be positioned to serve as the agents. So anyway, so I think those are some of the sort of the ideas that I'm playing around with. But I think, you know, the other good thing is that, you know, look, in this world, I think it's still going to be like a really weird transition time going from labor to capital. But it's also, in the long run, it's just a beautiful thing for humans. Like, I think this is going to be awesome where, yeah, for the first time, you know, you can just create whatever you want and there is no barrier. And like all of our ideas around like the last wave of software, I think all of that's going to be relevant. So it's pretty cool.
You're not about to go fund the next wave of great SaaS.
Yeah, definitely not. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, one thing I wanted to ask you, DK, is you had shared in our chat that you were chatting with someone that, you know, one other place this could accrue. I just read it super quickly, so I didn't get all the details, was, you know, potentially to Noster somehow, or some of the identity stuff involved with this, or the agents. Maybe it was, I don't know. What was the gist of that idea?
Is this the, I think we're talking about a mutual friend had asked, how he should think about advising his kids on where to spend their time. Is that the topic?
I'm interested in that as well, but I think you shared something along the lines. Let's find it out. Let's see. The shift to crypto equities or something. I thought that was.
Yeah. That was kind of the point that I was mentioning around the DeepSeek stuff, which is just that it's, you know, as it's going to become very cheap and free to build software, I think like any software that gets built is either kind of trends toward free for everybody to use, unless it had something of like an identity or a network effect component to it. Like the more people that use a particular thing, the better it is for everybody. And we don't really see that. I mean, we see that like in social networks. So like Noster would be an example of that kind of thing. And we see that in some other, like a data oriented business. Like if it turned out that like, because of the queries I put into OpenAI made your experience in OpenAI better because they had more data, they could train it better, tune it better, et cetera, then that would be a network effect. But I think we have clear evidence that that kind of thing doesn't really matter compared to the frontier of training and knowledge and distillation on the models and all of the data that can sort of be distilled from previous ones, right? Which is kind of like, you know, kind of calls into question, what is the future of IP even? But yeah, I mean, I think identities are a credible way to build new products still. And I don't think that's going away soon, but I also don't know that you need a ton of early capital to instigate those things. Like oftentimes, you know, in the case of Nostr's, it's not even a nonprofit. It's just like a protocol that a bunch of people use together to do stuff together. So to me, it feels like the future is that's an example of like the future is open and free and, you know, nobody's really in control and it's chaotic and weird, but like, I don't know. That's kind of the future. This seems just like an inevitability to me. You know, it may take a while, maybe a weird and wandering path to get there, but that was the identity point, I think.
We should make sure when you're back, DK, you put flowers on your hair, go over to Golden Gate Park, you know, it'd be pretty fun.
I think real hippiedom was right. It just hasn't been tried.
There's a hot take.
Like, you know, the hippies were like, oh, peace, love, let's all do it as a commune. And in reality is when you have like scarce physical, you know, rival goods that need to be divided, who's going to do the chores? Who's going to have access to the rival goods? Like in that world, like
rival goods.
Yeah. Right. Like hippies were like, maybe right, but a little too early.
Summer of love 2025.
Ooh, yeah. It's coming.
They're